Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. As today we talk about some of the most important data sets that were presented and published in the past year in renal cell cancer and urothelial bladder cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Matt Malowski from the UNC University of North Carolina, Lindberger Comprehensive Cancer Center in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Professor Tom Powles from the Queen Mary University of London and the director of the Barts Cancer Institute in London. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by the faculty, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we always do in our webinars, we really would appreciate if you could take this quick one-minute pre-meeting and post-meeting survey at the end of the meeting. We'll get a lot more out of this, and you will too. If you're into audio programs, we know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. Check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a program we did with Dr. Dineshman on non-metastatic urothelial bladder cancer. We do webinars all the time. Next week, we continue our series on ER-positive triple-negative breast cancer with Dr. Tulaney from Dana-Farber. And then on Wednesday, we're going to do a very interesting and different approach to webinars following two satellites we did at the recent GI Cancer Symposium on gastroesophageal and HCC. Check that out on next Wednesday. And then on Wednesday, March the 22nd, we'll continue our Meet the Professor colorectal cancer series. Then we're heading out to the SGO meeting. We're going to do two satellites there, but we'll also be broadcasting those live. So first on Sunday, March the 26th, a program on ovarian cancer, and the following day, endometrial cancer. Some hot news coming out at SGO, IO plus chemo. Have you heard that before? First-line therapy, two positive phase 3 trials. We'll see where that's heading. And then we're going to do another webinar on AML and MDS on April the 4th. But today we're here to talk about renal cell cancer and bladder cancer. And as we do for all our year in review programs, I met individually with each of the faculty members over the last couple weeks to record their in-depth presentation. They go through a whole bunch of papers in detail, and we really they're in the chat room. We're going to send it out by email. These are really great comprehensive presentations. Here are the papers on RCC that Tom reviewed, quite a few as you can see. And here are the papers on urothelial bladder cancer that Matt reviews. Again, so much new stuff coming out. We can't begin to talk about every single one of these tonight, but I picked out some of the themes and some of the questions that I'm hearing from docs in practice in terms of clinical management, also where things are heading in the future. You know, HER2-positive urothelial bladder cancer, who thought we'd be talking about that, but we are. So here's where we're heading. This is an outline of some of the key issues we're going to be getting into tonight with these two diseases. We're going to start out with RCC. And Matt, here are three of the questions that really made major questions that Tom, really a lot of the papers that he addressed, cover. So first, the use of adjuvant therapy, and particularly immunotherapy, but also first-line therapy for metastatic disease, particularly management of favorable versus non-favorable risk disease. And finally, some of the really, a lot of exciting new developments, new combinations, particularly on the horizon. We're going to really just start out talking about the papers in abstract. We'll show you a few of the slides, but just really more to get into the issues here. So first, the issue of adjuvant therapy, and we saw some follow-up data, Tom, that you commented on in your presentation from the Pembro study. Anything you want to say about that? It looks like these findings are holding up. How do you see people in the community responding? I'm going to ask Matt the same question. And how are you approaching this question? Who are the patients you're offering adjuvant therapy to?
I saw five patients in clinic yesterday, all of whom were eligible regarding the criteria. So it's a specific group, high-grade T2, T3, N1 patients with clear cell disease within 12 weeks of the operation. Of those five patients, four of the five, my discussion is there's a big positive trial out there. It clearly has a disease-free survival advantage. The the reduction in the risk of progression is over 30%, which is relevant. Now, that if you've got a 50% chance of relapse, that's a 30% of that 50%. So, you know, one of the patients said, oh, hold on a minute, I've only got a 30% chance of relapse. That means I've got a 0%. No, it's 30% of that 30, so that 30 goes from 20. And it's important that patients understand that concept because it's not an absolute 30% reduction. So it's 30% of their risk, reduction in the risk of relapse. Relapse in kidney cancer is a bad thing. Patients, you're on therapy for the rest of your life, and long-term salvage is by no means guaranteed. But a year of infusions are associated with a 10% chance of life-changing toxicity. And that's really important. And that ranges from neurological toxicity to diabetes. It ranges from pneumonitis to thyroid dysfunction. You know, it's a broad spectrum of potential problems. And we've done a series of other trials which have not been positive. And that includes trials we expected to be positive, including Ipi-Nivo, for example. The one caveat I say is their overall survival data, which is really important, is currently immature, but it is trending in the right direction. We've seen a survival signal. The hazard ratio is 0.53. Now, there haven't been that many deaths yet, but there will be more. But at the moment, that's a 50% or 47% reduction in the risk of death. Underpowered, immature, but at the moment, it's fair to say that from an efficacy perspective, for pembrolizumab, it's pointing in the right direction. And actually, of those five patients, three went on and decided to have it. One said they're coming back next week. And a fifth patient decided against having it.
And I'd love to be making rounds with you, but coming back to you, Matt, you know, one of the issues here that has to be considered, we just did a program at the GU Symposium, and there was a patient we talked about who had, I think, a history of, quote, colitis. And just a whole question of how hard are you going to push in these patients either to start or continue if they're having problems, knowing that, you know, some of these people are cured. We can't say which ones they are. And I find in general that the tolerance for autoimmune toxicity is less in the, you know, we're now starting to see adjuvant IOs in lung cancer and other places. And you see people with less tolerance to autoimmune issues in the adjuvant setting than metastatic disease. How do you think that sort of issue through, Matt?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. You know, I just saw a patient like this. It was related to adjuvant therapy and bladder cancer, and they had started on nivolumab and then actually developed colitis in the context of adjuvant therapy. And it's a long conversation, particularly, you know, without having a biomarker to really understand who is most likely to derive benefit and the potential risk of recurrent, you know, autoimmune disease. I mean, Tom's done some beautiful work looking at, you know, circulating tumor DNA. And hopefully that will be able to provide, you know, more information to be able to really, you know, think about that risk benefit with patients and have really more meaningful discussions. So I think it is a complicated issue, and I do consider it. And if someone has an autoimmune toxicity, I think one needs to be very thoughtful about continuing in the adjuvant setting.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about circulating DNA and also related to bladder cancer. We talk about adjuvant therapy there. You know, I was mentioning in the introduction, we're doing a program of colorectal cancer there. From what I'm seeing, I see the most development of circulating DNA affecting treatment decisions. I mean, they're literally making decisions in some situations in the adjuvant setting of colon cancer based on these assays. Can you summarize what we know about this in RCC, Tom, and whether you think this may be the way adjuvant therapy is going to be done in the future?
Well, it's a timely discussion, Neil, because there were two posters, or one particularly strong poster, at ASCO GU. The feeling has always been kidney cancer is a relatively quiet tumor from a mutational perspective compared to urothelial cancer, for example. And therefore, identification of mutations is hard. Some of the panel-based approaches, where we pre-specify genes, those panels are usually designed for breast, lung, and colorectal cancer, and those genes don't tend to apply in kidney cancer. And so it would come as no surprise that using those panel-based approaches, we had a lot of false positives, because there is a false positive rate with because of clonal hematopoiesis. And we had relatively quiet tumors that weren't identified. So lots of negative samples on patients with cancer. A different approach is now being pursued, two approaches. One looking at methylation signatures in the blood. And there was a paper in Nature Meds from Tony Chueri's group in that. And I think that's really promising. That's relatively cheap as well, by the way, relatively easy to mass produce. And then at ASCO GU, we saw a personalized approach where whole exome sequencing on the primary tumor is performed, identification of mutations and tracking of those mutations. We saw some previous data from the MD Anderson in a smaller group of patients using a similar technique. In advanced disease, 70% of patients are positive, 90% non-clear cell were positive, papillary were positive. Again, relatively modest numbers. But I think that whether this can be applied with accuracy in the perioperative setting, I don't know yet. But the really important point, Neil, is that the technology is moving incredibly quickly. And so when I go to advisory boards on this topic and we hear from the companies that are working on this and the university groups, we'll go around the room talking about depth of sequencing, which is really important. And it really is a game of high stakes poker where we go around the room and people keep raising about the possibility of going deeper and deeper. So I think even in these relatively quieter tumors, we're going to be able to find mutations. I think circulating tumor DNA will have a role to play in kidney cancer.
So, yeah, of course, when I was talking about colon cancer, we're talking about tumor-informed circulating DNA. That's the assay that's really changed their strategy. When we get to bladder, we were talking in Tom's presentation about looking at circulating DNA in the urine, which I think is really interesting, but we'll get to that in a second. Larry, let's dive into the deep controversy. This is how we got warmed up before we were started. So first-line therapy, metastatic disease. I've been trying to figure it out for the last couple of years as I listen to everybody here. I'm going to kind of share some of my thoughts and see whether or not it resonates with people. But I've been kind of confused, to be honest with you. I thought I had it down, and then I sort of lost it. Anyhow, Tom's presentation, he goes through. No, it's not that. It's that it's just complicated for my simple mind. But in any event, I'm going to let you two both explain it in a second. But again, what the sort of the basis of this, Tom in this talk goes through the recent ASCO guideline and some of the updates and some of the important studies, the CheckMate 9ER study with Nivo and Cabo, the CLEAR study with lenvatinib pembro. I think we saw some more data on that recently. Ipi-Nivo also, we saw more data. And of course, the whole issue of the triplets and the COSMIC 313 approach of cabozantinib, Nivo, and Ipi, among others. I just want to kind of just take a step back and first talk about the favorable risk of patient, then we'll talk about the other patients. But the favorable risk is kind of what I've always been sort of confused about, Tom, because I know from listening to you all that the Ipi-Nivo doesn't seem to benefit, at least the main study there. But I'm just not clear exactly what the optimal therapy of these patients. My simplified approach is a favorable risk is no cytopenias, good performance status, and at least a year or more since initial diagnosis to metastatic disease. So I want to know, Tom, you have a patient like that, they're favorable risk. How do you think through their therapy, both if they're asymptomatic or they're symptomatic?
So, Neil, you started on the more difficult group. I can talk for 20 seconds on intermediate and poor risk, but we're going to park that and focus on the good risk patients. I think one has to start by going back in time a little bit. When the first data sets came out, sunitinib outperformed Ipi-Nivo in all parameters. And for that reason, Ipi-Nivo was not approved in that data set for good risk. Axi-Pembro data came out and it outperformed sunitinib in all parameters in the good risk population. The OS wasn't significant, but it was trending in the right direction. The median follow-up for these trials was only 12 months. As these data sets have matured, the PFS and response rates remain largely similar. So VEGF TKI IO is still outperforming sunitinib clearly, but the OS hazard ratio compared to sunitinib for all of these combinations has now come essentially to one. And therefore, it's reasonable for the cynics or the non-IO believers or the patient who wants to minimize toxicity or those that can't afford to have immune therapy, it's reasonable for those people to say there's no clear survival advantage with longer follow-up with VEGF-TKI IO over VEGF-TKI, and therefore VEGF-TKI has become a reasonable alternative. Whereas I think when we first started this journey, we thought axi-pembro, cabo-nivo, and len-pen in the end was going to knock it out the water for survival. That's not happened. And as the facts change, our minds need to change as well. And controversially, the ipi-nivo data has also gone in a similar direction. So the hazard ratio started at 1.6 versus sunitinib, so 60% worse, clearly not great. But now the overall hazard ratio has come out at 1 as well. It's actually 0.93. So people like Mike Atkins and others are saying, well, this data is good. It's only 5-year data. We haven't got seen the 10 or 20-year data. Should we be giving immune therapy to these patients? Now, that's a very controversial statement. And because it's not licensed, I think it should be avoided. So as I see it, and I'm not sure if IPI's adding very much, I suspect the long-term data, which we haven't seen yet, axi-pembro, cabo-nivo, len-pen, giving a PD-1 to these patients, is that the right thing to do? And my approach to it at the moment is a bit bespoke. It's a bit patient-focused. I say to patients, this is where we are. There's going to be a bit more toxicity. The long-term data, the 10, 15-year data, we don't know yet. The 5-year survival data, probably about the same. You're going to get a higher response rate, but you've got good risk disease anyway. Do you need that higher response rate? It's quite a difficult conversation. And certainly my experience of this, again, clinic over the last few weeks, my experience is some patients with comorbidity, some of the elderly patients, some of them are saying, look, actually, what about surveillance? Do I need any treatment at all? If you're saying to me, if I haven't got aggressive disease, I've got good risk, and it's my preference actually to pursue surveillance for a little bit in actually quite a big cohort of good risk patients. I'd like to see the cancers growing. I don't like to treat good risk disease unless I've got a scan showing the cancer's getting larger. Often with good risk disease, with a couple of lung metastases, you do repeat the CT scan, it doesn't change very much. So I would like to put surveillance on that table as well. And of course, people in the audience will say, well, what about radiofrequency ablation and surgery? And I think for one or two metastases, that might be an option as well. So it is a complicated piece. There are lots of options. And I think that that the facts are changing with time.
So, Matt, I'm curious about your thoughts about this. This happens so often in oncology that these decisions are just, hard to really say there's one right answer. And a lot of times we start talking about involving the patient, if they want to be involved, if they can understand. How do you think through these cases in your clinic, Matt?
Yeah, no, I think, Tom's last point, I think, is really one of the most important things that folks need to consider, which is surveillance. I mean, there's been quite a bit of nice data demonstrating the ability to surveil patients. And in one study, the median time to initiation of therapy was on the order of about 15 months, so between 1 to 2 years. And so I think I had a conversation with a patient today with metastatic renal cell cancer, favorable risk disease, with really oligometastatic disease for who we decided on surveillance. And so I think that's number one. To remember when you're seeing these patients. I think the other thing to consider with regard to the doublet therapies in a patient who wants to receive a particularly aggressive type of approach to management is that, to my knowledge, we really don't cure people with VEGFR-TKI therapy. And I think, there are, as Tom mentioned, some strong believers in immunotherapy, and we certainly do see those durable responses with immunotherapy. And so I think in that patient who certainly the data supports it and wants that approach without the real knowledge that it's necessarily going to lead to that durability or cure, certainly adding IO to VEGFR-TKI certainly could make sense. And then I think there's going to be populations of patients, Neil, that are you know, equally as likely to do well with VEGFR TKI. There may be those with IO alone. I think, again, Tom and others have done some exciting work with regard to gene expression profiling to be able to sort out, you know, who those groups of patients might be who are more or less likely to respond to combination approaches or approaches with, you know, VEGFR TKI alone or IO. And so hopefully that will be the future.
So let's talk about non-favorable risk. Tom said he could summarize it in 20 seconds, but I also want to know what you see as the current or future role of triplet therapies as the one we just referred to. But in the 20s, I mean, the theme that I think a lot of us have heard in these patients, Tom, is that in the long run, ipi-nivo maybe is the best choice unless they have symptomatic disease or so much disease that you really want to see a response. Is that your sort of clinical way you think it through?
No, I'm not sure that's right. So the landmark analysis and the hazard ratios in the intermediate and poor risk populations, remember that we tend to look at hazard ratios for the VEGF TKI IOs in the ITT population, and the good risk is one, so that drags the hazard ratio in the wrong direction. Whereas with ipi-nivo, we only look at intermediate and poor. And so their hazard ratios are always 4 or 5 points better. But if you look at the VEGF TKI IOs in the intermediate and poor, they track ipi-nivo with time almost identically. The landmark analysis for the study arm, the doublet arms of these trials for ipi-nivo, cabo-nivo, and Lemped and Axi Pembro, landmark analysis, almost identical. So I think it's premature to say ipi-nivo has the best survival data. Don't get me wrong, it's good data. There are issues around access to subsequent therapies in the control arms, which I think can contaminate the studies, making cross-trial comparisons somewhat futile again. So I don't think it's right to say it has. I think all four have got great maturity of data, and there are many, many more similarities and differences between them. I think it is fair to say the VEGF TKI IOs are better at getting initial control of disease, and I think we all agree on that. And I think that it's also fair to say that long-term VEGF TKI therapy, which is obviously the case on the triplets with VEGF, because it's VEGF TKI forever, we don't stop it, that's associated with toxicity. So I would say I'd say all four have similar outcome data in the long term. They're tracking each other very carefully and closely. VEGF TKI, better initial control, probably better quality of life with ipi-nivo.
Interesting. Before I hear what Matt has to say about that, any comments about the role of the triplet?
Ipi-nivo. Yeah. So the triplet has response rates of about 45%, CR rates of 3%. It has cabo ipi-nivo didn't perform from a response perspective as high as the high expectations that we had to give a triplet. So I always say Bernard Escudier and I had a discussion about it before we started the trial. He was looking for 25% CR rates. And so I think for many, that was, less than they were hoping. It's important to remember the trial was positive and the hazard ratio of 0.74, a recent update at GU-ASCO, 0.73 from PFS is a significant delay in PFS in 800 patients. We are going to need to see overall survival before we really get behind this triplet, because we did see more toxicity, as you would expect. And there are some people who feel that the three drugs together are slightly more difficult to give than the two drugs. And there may be some issues around the dosing of those drugs because of that. And I think that's an okay summary. There is something subtle in the difference between the intermediate and poorest patients. It looks like the benefit for the triplet was mainly confined to the intermediate risk patients. And that gives us some underlying indication around the biology. We were just talking about how good sunitinib was in the good risk patients. And it looks like actually the VEGF TKIs are best in the good risk patients and the immune therapies are absolutely crucial in the poor risk patients. And the exemplar of that is those sarcomatoid patients with porous disease, whose disease has been completely transformed with immune therapy. And ipi-nivo is a great treatment for those patients.
So, Matt, sometimes I kind of view myself as almost like a translator to from between the investigators and the docs in practice. I'm constantly trying to, I'm not going to say simplify it, but just kind of just figure out the global message. It sounds like I haven't quite got it exactly right in terms of non-favorable disease. It sounds a lot more complicated than at least my simple model. How do you think through these decisions, Matt?
Yeah, no, I think Tom's points are excellent ones. You know, I think that the take home, Neil, honestly, is that those trials, as Tom suggested, are tracking beautifully. These are all really active therapies for our patients and have led to tremendous advances in survival outcomes. And, you know, what I would say is that, yes, when you're trying to harness responses and deal with more complex situations with patients that, you know, need those responses soon, then I reach for IO-VEGFR-TKI. I mean, if you look at that updated paper that came out, you know, I think it was this morning or yesterday from the CLEAR study, I mean, you know, 71, Tom, was it, percent response rate with a 17% CR rate for lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. That's pretty extraordinary. And so I agree there, and I think that's the way that I would think about it. We have a clinical trial looking at the pedigree study, so looking at ipi-nivo and then based on response, the addition of cabozantinib. So I think having clinical trials is obviously a luxury that we have in some of the academic medical centers to be able to try to answer some of these questions even better. With regard to the triplet, I don't think it's ready for prime time for the reasons that were suggested. You know, I think toxicity concerns and although, you know, yes, positive from a PFS.
So let's throw in a quick real case from the chat room. Nabin has a patient with metastatic RCC who's progressed after 15 months of ipi-nivo, is on cabo, started a few months ago, had slow progression, wasn't tolerating very well, dose reduced, now florid progression. Matt, what would you be thinking about next in this patient's had ipi-nivo followed by cabo?
Yeah, so, you know, ipi-nivo followed by cabo, so got immunotherapy, you know, got, you know, what some would consider our best, you know, tyrosine kinase inhibitor. An option for this patient, you know, that one would consider outside of a study, you could consider the combination of lenvatinib and everolimus, which I think would be reasonable. And so, so that's probably what I would be thinking about in someone like this who's progressed after ipi-nivo and cabo.
So another doc in the chat room, Tom Nabin, also has a patient, I guess because you mentioned sarcomatoid, metastatic RCC sarcomatoid, progressed after 8 months of ipi-nivo, confirmed with scans and biopsy. Second line for sarcomatoid, Tom, after ipi-nivo.
Yeah, really interesting. So the majority, there has been an update from the ipi-nivo data set. More than 50% went into a long-term durable remission with sarcomatoid cancers. I think this patient's unfortunate and hasn't been one of those 50%. That's a real problem. I mean, clearly VEGF-TKI at this point is a, you know, cabo is an option for these patients, but I think this is going to end badly, I'm afraid. But I would go for cabozantinib at this point. But it's, you know, genuine progression after immune therapy with sarcomatoid tumors doesn't go well.
So, Tom, one other thing I wanted to ask you about is the issue. You made the point many times. You had a graphic with three sets of identical twins that, in your mind, represented the three TKI-IO combinations. But I was wondering, and it seems like these IO-TKI combinations, the toxicity is influenced by the toxicity of the TKI. You know, you're talking about lenvatinib pembro, and lenvatinib is not always the easiest TKI to use. You know, one of the things that you comment on, kind of almost the forgotten drug, tivozanib, we saw some follow-up data at ASCO last year. I'm just kind of curious. I know it's being looked at with an IO. Do you think that the type of IO that you, I know there's other experimental IOs that are being looked at in renal cell. I'm just kind of curious, Tom, what your thoughts are in terms of how much the TKI you combine with the IO affects the tolerability and how you view the tolerability of TiVo, for example, compared to the other TKIs.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that tivozanib is a drug which had a difficult start to its development. There was a trial probably more than a decade ago now, a frontline randomized phase 3 versus sorafenib, which had a forced crossover, not forced, but an optional crossover in the sorafenib arm to get second-line tivozanib. And in that study, there was a survival signal for the control arm. The reality was that many patients in the tivozanib arm never got second-line therapy. And the trial actually showed probably the importance of second-line therapy versus first-line therapy. And tivozanib never really got an FDA approval off the back of that. The drug was revived in a study called TiVo-3, which again was tivozanib versus sorafenib. You might say that's risky doing the same experiment twice. But on this occasion, there was no forced crossover, and it was in advanced disease. And in that trial, heavily pre-treated advanced disease. And in that trial, there was again a progression-free survival advantage, but no survival difference on this occasion. And for that reason, the drug has been approved and is more widely used now. I think it is a well-tolerated agent. I think if you said to me, is it better tolerated than axitinib? I would say probably not. Do we need lots of additional VEGF TKIs? Probably not. Is there any reason not to use tivozanib? No, it's a perfectly good drug if you want to use it. Should you switch from sunitinib to tivozanib tomorrow? Not if you're comfortable with sunitinib. Sunitinib has its challenges as well. But I think it's reasonable to explore tivozanib prospectively because it does look like quite a good partner. And it's being explored in a number of different studies, one of which is tivozanib plus nivolumab in refractory, in VEGF and IO refractory disease. And so it's a drug we may hear more about. It hasn't majorly altered the landscape of what we do. It's an additional part of our armory, but I don't think in the end it's improving the survival of our patients because there are other alternatives. Cabo, Pazo, sunitinib, the list goes on.
So, Tom, in the case that Neil presented to me with that patient who progressed after IO and cabozantinib, and I had mentioned lenvatinib, what would you do, and where does TiVo fit in? And just curious on your thoughts there.
Yeah, so I think, firstly, I'd like to start with the lenvatinib issue, if I may. That was a randomized phase 2 study of len-everolimus versus len versus everolimus. Len-everolimus, it had 50 patients in each arm. There was everolimus didn't perform particularly well in that trial. It hasn't performed that well in kidney cancer. And you'll be aware that mTOR inhibitors, cabozantinib as a single agent, has beaten everolimus for PFS and for OS as well. The survival signal in that study wasn't clear because clearly it's only 50 patients. And the history of everolimus has not been spectacular. And the combination of len-everolimus had a PFS advantage in the front line against sunitinib. Remember that it was part of the CLEAR trial, one of three arms. But again, from a survival perspective, actually it trails trending in the wrong direction. So it's hard to say that it's clearly better than sunitinib, and it's underpowered to say it has a survival advantage versus everolimus alone. And with only 50 patients, it's difficult to say too much about it. So, and of course, combinations are more complicated than single agents. And the previous history of combining mTOR inhibition with VEGF TKI hasn't been particularly positive. So the bevacizumab trials and the other trials, the frontline trials we performed, haven't performed well. So I'm not a great believer in the combination with that 50-patient study and with the track record of everolimus previously. But then you might say to me, Tom, well, what can you do that's better? And the reality is I struggle. I think that, you could switch to axitinib and it's probably not going to do very much. Sunitinib, pretty broad spectrum, probably has got some activity that Cabo doesn't have. Lenvatinib as a single agent is a pretty active drug. I suspect that len-everolimus would not beat lenvatinib on PFS or on OS in any setting if you did a big powered randomized phase 3. So, you know, I'd say switch to VEGF TKI. I don't think you have to give len everolimus. It's obviously licensed and it's reasonable. But the reality is this patient's going to do poorly if they're progressing quickly after that.
Well, let's move on now and talk about bladder cancer, just to recommend in Tom's talk. He also goes into this really interesting idea. Belzutifan is such an interesting agent, but the combination with cabozantinib looks really promising and interesting. Also, this new TKI XL092 being looked at in non-clear cell seems kind of similar to cabo. We'll see how it plays out. And Tom's summary of where we are. Let's talk a little bit about urothelial bladder cancer. Some of the questions that I think come up in, Matt, your talk are three big areas in addition to a bunch of other things, but particularly the issue of non-muscle invasive disease, particularly IOs, adjuvant IO, and then sequencing of therapy in metastatic disease. And one thing that you, in terms of non-muscle invasive disease, I mean, I hate to admit it, but I wasn't really aware, I'm not sure how many medical oncologists are, that the actual approval for Pembro in non-muscle invasive disease is only sort of part of the spectrum of non-muscle invasive disease. And then we saw now at the one of the papers you went through that was presented at the GU symposium was from that same trial, another cohort, a different cohort, looked kind of similar outcomes in terms of the benefit. But can you kind of clarify what the initial data looked at, the approval was, and sort of for us who are not urologists, like what the difference is?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I don't think you're the only one confused, Neil. You know, I think it's really new to medical oncologists to get involved in this space, and it's really important to understand what these criteria mean. And so, you know, in high risk, first of all, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer in patients with BCG unresponsive disease, the standard of care is radical cystectomy. And so that's the first thing that's really important to understand, that this is a major issue because patients need to undergo surgery as a standard. With regard to the BCG unresponsive space, these are essentially established and endorsed criteria by the FDA for adequate BCG and also for BCG unresponsive disease, which I won't go into the details, but it's important to understand and could be broadly lumped into persistent, recurrent, and progressive disease. In the KEYNOTE-57 study, what you're referring to, which was looking at pembrolizumab, there are two cohorts. Cohort A was the initial cohort, and this is what the approval came from. So this was a cohort of patients with carcinoma in situ with or without papillary tumors. And what this essentially demonstrated is that there was a complete response rate, which was a primary endpoint at 3 months of about 40%. What was seen, however, was that the durability of that response rate was on the order of about a little less than 20% if one looked sort of 12 months on. And so based on the, you know, the activity and really the absence of therapies in the context of non-muscle invasive BCG unresponsive disease, this was approved. There was another cohort, which was cohort B, and Andrea Necki presented that data at the GU Cancer Symposium, and that was the cohort of patients without CIS. So these are patients with papillary disease, high-grade T1 TA. These patients treated similarly with up to 2 years of pembrolizumab with assessments to look for recurrence of disease, had either persistent, recurrent, or progressive disease, about 57% TA, about 43% T1 patients. And what Dr. Necki showed was that if you looked at 12 months, the primary endpoint here was disease-free survival, was about 44%. And if you looked at 24 and 36 months, it fell to about 35%. From a tolerability standpoint, you know, sort of the typical toxicity that we see with immune checkpoint inhibitors. So here about, you know, about 14% grade 3-4 toxicity and about, you know, I think it was about 11% of patients that required discontinuation of therapy. So, you know, I think that, you know, in summary, I mean, you know, activity both in the CIS cohort, in the papillary without CIS cohort, in a space where we don't have or although are developing many new therapies. And so I think this is now sort of one option among many that are coming down the pike quickly for patients with BCG unresponsive disease. And we'll have to sort of look at these and see which of these therapies appear to offer patients the greatest benefit without really having comparative studies at the moment.
So, Tom, any thoughts about the evolving research platform of non-muscle invasive disease? It's, once the Pembro study came out, but there's so many other things. And Matt went through, you can see a whole bunch of trials. This really interesting ADAPT bladder study combining Anio, durvalumab with BCG and a bunch of other things in sort of an interesting paradigm. Also, targeted therapy in non-muscle invasive disease with erdafitinib. I was mentioning also the issue of maybe the introduction of cell-free DNA into the management of these patients. We're going to talk a little bit about TAR-200 in a second, but just any comments in general about this sort of clinical research platform, Tom, that seems to be rapidly evolving in this setting?
Yeah, well, I agree with what Matt has said. I think that the pembrolizumab piece in CIS BCG refractory disease has perhaps not taken off quite as much as some people might have expected in the US. And then I think behind it, there is a second generation or a different generation of drugs, intravesical drugs, IL-15 superagonist, which looks to have terrific activity with good landmarks, good CR landmarks at 1 year, enstiladrin, which has been around and discussed for a while, which I think is relevant. And then there's also, we had ASCO GU, we saw some really nice data with erdafitinib, really preliminary, a handful of patients, again, in the same setting where we're seeing good CR rates in the BCG refractory CIS population. In terms of the future, we have some big randomized trials. We've got the CREST trial and we've got the POTOMAC trial. And this is in CIS and perirenal cancer. And this is not in BCG refractory disease, but it's in the frontline setting. And these big randomized phase 3 studies will really define for us the activity of immune checkpoint inhibition in this space. So I think that I think this is an area which is evolving quickly. I think it's very exciting. I don't think pembrolizumab has taken off yet. And I don't think immune checkpoint inhibition is yet shown to be the go-to drug in this space. And I think some of the intravesical alternatives are as attractive.
Yeah, I was just going to add to what Tom said. He's spot on. I mean, I think that, you know, if you look at some of these, Neil, even from a sort of quality of life standpoint with patients, you know, like nadofaragene firadenovec, which is essentially a non-replicating adenovirus that encodes for interferon alpha-2b, you know, that's given at 3-month intervals intravesically, right? And so that's approved now. That's going to move forward and be available to patients. And, you know, I think that things like that, certainly from a urologist standpoint, are going to take off much faster than systemic therapy.
The other thing I'd like you to comment on, and I first heard about this in non-muscle invasive disease, but the paper you presented was in muscle invasive disease, but the so-called PRETZL, the intravesicular device, this is TAR-200, which is gemcitabine. But can you talk a little bit about what this is? To me, it's fascinating what this device is, what we know about it, both in this look in muscle invasive disease, but also non-muscle invasive. There's another TAR, I think it's 210 or something, that's erdafitinib delivered by this so-called PRETZL. So what's the deal here?
Yeah, well, it's a PRETZL because it looks like a PRETZL. And it's got essentially a drug that's continuously released for whatever the dwelling period is. In this case, it's 7 days. And so, you know, the TAR-200 experience in non-muscle has been promising. And in muscle invasive disease, there was a nice paper that Sia Danishmad published that showed activity in the MIA-BC space since patients who were not eligible for cisplatin-based chemotherapy or refused, and showed that, you know, preliminary, if you looked at anti-tumor activity, you know, in patients with larger tumors, CR rate was about 40% and 60% in patients with smaller tumors, less than 3 centimeters. Granted, you know, handful of patients, 10 patients in each cohort, but I think certainly very promising TAR-210 as well, you know, looking at erdafitinib in molecularly selected patients. So I think this sort of intravesical drug delivery system, again, is happening now. There's different potential agents that could be incorporated that we know are active. And so this is certainly a really exciting area.
So Tom, any thoughts on this? Also, Matt reviewed this SignRise 4 trial. This, to me, this is really cool. So TAR-200 plus an IO, sotrelimab. Any thoughts about this method of drug delivery, Tom?
So I think Matt's absolutely right. The SignRise 4 study is one of a number of, will come as no surprise to you, there's a SignRise 1, 2, and 3. And it's one of a wider program of exploration with this device, this intravesical device. I think it will look probably back on back in time. We'll look at, you know, squirting something into the bladder, getting the patient to joggle around for a little bit, and then peeing it out. I think we'll see that as, you know, as fairly 1920s medicine. It is not logical that that's going to be the most effective way of delivering drugs into the bladder. And clearly, this is a more effective way of drug delivery. And I suspect, I don't know this, but I suspect that this sort of approach is going to be more effective than the rather haphazard approach of squirting stuff in and peeing it out 20 minutes or a couple of hours later. So I think this is a really exciting piece. It's also possible to be practice-changing in a spectacular way. Because some of these discussions we've had previously about CIS and about G3T1 disease, and, you know, we could transform the disease, maybe even T2 disease. We could transform the disease by releasing something chronically into the bladder. And one of the things I'd like to see, obviously I want to see frontline metastatic urothelial cancer patients. We want to improve their survival by 50%. You know, we need to do that. We need to introduce personalized therapy. We need to do that. But in the perioperative space, we need to make a big difference as well. You know, neoadjuvant chemotherapy, only a 5 to 12% survival benefit, pretty modest. We've not seen a survival benefit yet for adjuvant nivolumab. So our perioperative drugs are subadequate. And we're also doing debilitating surgery on patients with these massive operations. So there's a huge amount of work to do in perioperative bladder cancer. And I genuinely think that TAR-200, this pretzel, has a role to play in that.
Yeah, I would add, Neil. Tom, I was just going to add one thing to what Tom said in terms of delivery systems. You know, there's another one that's approved in low-grade upper tract disease now, which is, you know, this MitoGel, which is really exciting. That's in the cold, it's liquid, but it warms up in the body. And then essentially it stays in contact with the tumor for up to 6 hours. And, you know, you see responses, you know, 60%, you see that the tumors resolve. And these are more nuisance type cancers, but in patients that could ultimately lose their kidney. So drug delivery systems like this are really exciting.
Super cool. All right. 30-second update on Checkmate 274. Matt Galsky presented it at the GU Symposium. Matt, you discussed it in your talk. Looks like the data are starting to hold up. Can you comment on the update? But in particular, your current clinical approach, are you using, you know, sort of the FDA guidelines to determine when to use this therapy?
Yeah, so the update is, as you suggested, it holds up. I mean, if you look at the ITT and the PD-L1 greater than or equal to 1% populations, you know, the hazard ratios are about what they were, 0.71, 0.52. I think one thing that was striking that Matt showed was that if you look at the PD-L1 greater than 1% population, the median DFS was about 52 months versus 8 months. And so I think that's a pretty strong signal here. And the, you know, the forest plot looks good. And all of the other endpoints look good. So, yeah, so, I mean, when I see patients who meet criteria, that is persistent muscle-invasive disease, you know, after neoadjuvant therapy or T3, T4, and our node-positive disease, you know, yes, there's not an OS right now, but I think with the DFS, I certainly have these conversations with patients and have been treating patients with adjuvant nivolumab. I there is, you know, data, which, you know, it's Tom, you know, again, has done some extraordinary work with ctDNA, you know, in Invigor 10, and we now have Invigor 11. And I hope that is the future to really be able to select patients. I think as we think about adjuvant therapy, regardless of what the situation disease is, you know, we want ways to be able to select those patients who are most likely to benefit and to avoid toxicity for those patients who will never benefit from our therapies or who don't need them.
So next topic. Enfortumab vedotin plus an IO plus pembrolizumab, and Matt went through a whole bunch of papers related to that topic. Again, I'll ask you to check out his presentation. But just kind of curious, I'll start with you, Tom. I think I mentioned to Matt that we actually had a case presented at the GU Symposium of Doc in Practice who somehow managed to get that combination first line in a patient who the doc felt was not eligible for a platinum therapy, period. Not just cisplatin, but platinum therapy. And I think everybody on the panel was like, whoa, that seemed like very radical. And then people were thinking, well, you know, really you're kind of combining the next two lines of therapy. You're hoping the patient's going to get, you know, their safety data. So Tom, there's a lot of excitement in investigators, and sometimes you all get all excited and it doesn't pan out. What are your thoughts about this approach, Tom? And does it seem logical to even want to do it right now in the first line setting and patients who are not eligible for chemo?
Yeah, so there's a randomized phase two study of 75 patients in both each arm, which shows EV Pembro in cisplatin ineligible patients has response rates of 65%, whereas the response rate for historically of chemotherapy is, you know, more like 40%. The PFS is 12 months as opposed to 6 months, and historical control for survival data, 24 months versus 10 months. So I can see why someone would look at that data and say, you know, I'd rather have that than cisplatin, than carboplatin-based chemotherapy. I think uvalumab adds something to the chemotherapy, obviously, but the challenge there is not all patients are eligible for uvalumab. You have to have responded to chemotherapy. I think that there's a study called EV-302, which is a randomized phase three, EV Pembro versus chemotherapy frontline, 800 patients. I think that trial's, you know, going to be really important. I think it's, if it can reproduce the data we've seen so far in two cohorts in cisplatin ineligible patients, by rights that trial should be positive. And I can see why patients and doctors are already saying, I'd like to give this combination to our patients. Important toxicity signals, early skin rash, please beware of early skin rash with EV. Later skin rash, easier, but in the first two cycles, please, please, please take that seriously. Stop the drug early, let the patient settle, reduce the dose of the drug, and it will be fine. I think that's really important. Longer peripheral neuropathy, which is also relevant. But Matt, you had some really interesting data, some quality of life data, and you were kind enough to share your slides with me. Maybe you could talk about that really quickly, because I thought that was a super cool update.
Right, and that's at the top of this with this slide. One of the things that came out, Matt, was the tolerability of the. Everybody's all excited about the efficacy, but now if you talk about a patient who's in comorbidities, can't get chemotherapy, how are they going to tolerate it? What did you see when you looked at patient-reported outcomes? For example, enfortumab alone versus the combination.
Yeah, so I think, thanks, Tom. Yeah, no, I think, you know, that was very exciting to see. I mean, I think some of the things, Neil, we've seen in the clinic is that when we do have patients with pain who come in and receive enfortumab, one of the things that investigators talk about among themselves is, you know, the pain seems to get better quickly. And so one of the things those PROs showed us is that, in fact, the observations that we were making in the clinic seemed to be accurate. And so what we saw is we saw clinically meaningful improvements in pain in these patients that came quickly. In particular, about two-thirds of patients had moderate to severe pain at baseline in the study. And, you know, about over 85% of patients had sustained improvement of pain. And the median time to sustained improvement was only 1.1 months. So I think that's pretty striking. I mean, for this combination, which has the efficacy and now has this really complementary PRO data associated with it.
Yeah, I love patient-reported outcomes. Now, some of the stuff now is starting to be more understandable to me now. That, like this pain, you can see that. You can understand it. I think they're really a fantastic addition to try to get particularly an early take on what's going on. So another topic that Matt reviewed, I'm just curious what your take is on this. Tom, there's updated data on erdafitinib. We talked a little bit about it in terms of being studied in non-muscle invasive disease, but of course the issue of metastatic disease. One common question that comes up is sequencing of therapy in these patients with FGFR alterations. Tom, when do you think of bringing in erdafitinib? Would you consider it before an antibody drug conjugate, either one of them?
Yeah, so I think we've seen an update of this data set. It's about 100 patients. It's for patients with FGFR alterations by a PCR technique. It's important to remember that there are now four or five different ways of measuring FGFR alterations, and each one is different. Some tests, only 20% are positive. Other tests, the rugaratinib data, 65% are FGFR positive. I mean, obviously, both can't be right. The response rate was 40%. And a PFS of about 6 months and OS in a region of around a year is, in a single arm trial, not that dissimilar to what we've seen with infortumab vedotin. But of course, it's a select group of patients. So we don't know too much about we certainly know nothing about cross comparison of trials. It's a different group of patients. I think it's reasonable at the moment to say infortumab vedotin has got level 1A evidence or big randomized phase 3 that's positive in this setting. We haven't yet seen that level of evidence for erdafitinib. It's important to acknowledge that erdafitinib also has a toxicity profile that's different from chemotherapy. Again, as with EV, it's not worse or better in my opinion, but it is different. If you're going to give the drug, you'll notice pretty quickly that patients get fatigued, sore hands, nail toxicity, sore mouth. So, you know, there is different toxicity profiles with these agents that requires education and training. I mean, my preference at the moment would be to give infortumab vedotin. I'm really excited about the THOR study. It's a randomized phase 3, essentially erda versus chemo or pembro. It's an incredible undertaking by J&J. They've screened literally thousands of patients to generate this randomized phase 3. They should be congratulated for that. And I think it's one of the most exciting studies in urothelial cancer.
So, Matt, any comments again on sequencing of the various areas? I always love to tell people in other specialties who know nothing about GU oncology that you guys have five lines of therapy approved. People can't believe that when they hear it. Anyhow, anything you want to add in terms of how you sequence these FGFR patients, Matt, but also any clinical pearls? Tom kind of provided an overview of the toxicity. But anything in particular you might want to highlight that maybe people could, you know, use a little update on?
Yeah, no, I agree with Tom. I mean, I think you can't not take into consideration the level one EV301 study. And so I sequence with infortimab and then would move to erdafitinib. I think Tom did a nice job with the toxicity. You know, I often say to patients, it's an oral agent versus an intravenous agent doesn't necessarily mean the toxicity is less at all. And, you know, the nail events are not inconsequential. And the other thing to be aware of is the ophthalmologic potential complications, the central serous retinopathy, the retinal pigment epithelial detachment, and the need for routine ophthalmologic evaluations in these patients. And, you know, it's hard enough to coordinate things in medicine and then coordinate them with another subspecialty. You know, maybe a little bit easier to do in the academic medical centers, but it's something that folks need to remember when treating these patients with erdafitinib for sure.
So, Tom, another issue that Matt got into in his talk was, of course, the other antibody drug conjugate approved here, sacituzumab govitecan, and also approved in breast cancer, both triple negative as well as ER positive. We saw some more data Dan Petrylak presented at the GU symposium. I just want to ask, we had another interesting case presented there, Tom, of a general oncologist in practice who decided to give sacituzumab before enfortumab because she felt like it was, based on her experience and what she'd read, that it would be better tolerated and equally efficacious. That's not the usual sequence that I hear investigators talk about. I hear investigators saying there's more mature data with enfortumab. Any thoughts about whether or not you can reverse that sequence or better off sticking with the standard?
So sacituzumab is also an antibody drug conjugate. It targets TROP2. It has a different payload. It's an SN38, a topoisomerase 1 payload. I think the clinical development through the TROPHY program is they've got a cohort of 114 patients that have been pretreated. Those 114 patients, their response rates, it's about 30%. Enfortumab vedotin has a response rate in a similar population of about 40%. When you combine it with chemotherapy, with immune checkpoint inhibition, its response rate is actually relatively modest at about, at about 40%, maybe 35%, somewhere around there. And so it doesn't appear to be quite the dynamite effect that we saw with EV Pembro. It's different studies and it's actually different settings. This is platinum refractory, whereas EV Pembro was untreated patients. So is it fair to say that its activity looks the same as EV? I think it's fair to say at the moment it has activity, but it probably hasn't quite got the triple A, breathtaking efficacy we saw with EV. It's probably, an AAB. And so there's a study called TROPiCS-4, which is a randomized phase 3, which is a remake of EV-301. And we are looking forward to the survival signal in that. And I think if that hits a survival signal, then both drugs will be largely seen as interchangeable. I think the response rate may be relevant. EV continually has a response rate as a single agent of 40%. And I think that if sacituzumab comes in at less than 25%, I think that would be a problem. The last question is it easier to give? And I think it's a fair question also. I'm going to have a go at answering that if I may. So I think when you look at levels grade 3 and 4 toxicity, they're not that dissimilar across different trials. Again, comparing trials across different studies is very hazardous. I wouldn't recommend it. But it's different toxicity. So it's got lethargy, diarrhea, and neutropenia. And G-CSF is actually widely recommended. So I don't think it's fair to say that it has equal efficacy and is better tolerated. I think it's fair to say it's very hard to compare the drugs. It has less mature data, and it's not clearly better as it currently stands.
So actually, the doc who presented the cases in the chat room tonight, and thanks you for that discussion, Dr. Rudolph. I guess we're not going to get to her too in this particular program. We'll pick it up next time, but as in a bunch of other tumors, seen some interesting things, particularly with antibody-drug conjugates. Matt and Tom, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Audience, thank you for attending. Call them back next week. Let's hear what Dr. Tulaney has to say about ER-positive, triple-negative, and, of course, HER2-low breast cancer. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much,
Thanks,
Matt.
Neil.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you so much.